You know, last weekend I was hiking with my family and we came across this group of teenagers and they were saying how they were going to look and try to track down a waterfall. And this idea came to mind. I can't believe it happened so quickly. But I said to them, hey now, don't go chasing waterfalls. Now, they're too young to know that TLC song. So they said, what do you mean? And I said, listen, just stick to the rivers and lakes you're used to, okay? Now, they had no idea what I was talking about, but it cracked me up and it gave me an idea. Why not go chasing waterfalls myself? So I am here in front of Tiffany Waterfalls. It's actually in Ancaster, and Hamilton area is home to over 100 waterfalls. So I thought I would this morning take us out, go teaching along some waterfall. Now, this one's a little crowded with people, so I'm actually going to take us up above the falls, and there's another little one there called Washboard Falls, and I'm going to do my teaching up there. So I'm going to head up over the waterfall, and there's a quiet little one tucked in behind it. So that's where I'm heading, but Nexus, good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'm looking forward to a teaching I have for us this morning. It's called Enchanted. This is Washboard Falls. We're technically in Ancaster right now, and it's a bit of a magical place, and I really wanted to come to a bit of an enchanted place, you could say, for this morning, because that's what I want to talk about, enchantment. You know, the Italian writer and poet Dante, in his book, The Divine Comedy, right towards the end of the book, he has this vision of God, and he writes this about it. He says, God is more than a glorious light, a blinding vision. He writes this, God is the love that moves the sun and other stars. And I love that line. It gets behind this idea that behind natural laws and what we can see and observe, there's an animating presence. God is an animating presence behind our whole entire world. He's alluding to, you could say, how our world is enchanted. And the idea of enchantment, of course, you could define it as, well, being under a spell, being under the influence of something, something magical or charmed. And so Dante's vision, it's the same as scriptures, it's of a world that is enchanted by God. Dante's idea, of course, is that the world is animated by something outside of us, which might sound like a strange idea, but we kind of understand this notion, particularly through things like alcohol and, say, falling in love, right? I mean, I think we all know that person who, when they have a bit too much alcohol, can either get a bit too lovey or maybe a bit too angry. There's something about the spirits of alcohol, you could say, that animates a person sometimes. It's the same as falling in love. When you come under the mad spell of falling in love, we're inclined to do some pretty crazy things. I mean, I remember when I first fell in love with Kristen, the things that I would do. I remember one night her calling at 11 o'clock and us chatting, and I said, I gotta see you. And I drove all the way to London at 11 at night and got back at 3 a.m. It was crazy, the snowstorms that I drove through just to see her. All of these things happen because we're under a spell. We're enchanted, be it falling in love, alcohol. In this case, the world, you could say, is enchanted by God. We are animated, all of it, by Him. Over the past few weeks, I've told you some stories, some that we might chalk up to coincidence, but the goal with all of those stories was to get us to maybe pause and go, maybe there is something more. And without getting into what caused it or necessarily the meaning, the idea of those stories is they stop us sometimes and they leave us wondering, maybe there is something more. More and more, I'm becoming convinced that faith is just as much a matter of perception as it is anything else. It's learning how to see and perceive that this world is enchanted and animated by God. As Paul says to the people in Athens when he's preaching there on Mars Hill, he says to them this, the God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. He himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. He is not far from any one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. Faith is, of course, about developing and becoming better people, growing. It's also about trusting certain things, but it's also a matter of perception, learning to see what is under the surface, bumping into God from time to time, this creator who animates the whole world and gives us life and breath and everything else. You see, the Apostle Paul later, he's writing to the church in Corinth. And this church in Corinth, they're so discouraged and they're down and they're falling into despair because there's so many quarrels and divisions happening among the church. Not like we've seen anything like that these days. Again, it's a similar time. There's a lot of division within the church and they're starting to doubt what this Christian path, if it's even meaningful at all. They're starting to doubt whether this resurrection event from Jesus, whether it matters at all. And Paul is writing to this discouraged group of people, and he says something interesting to them in 2 Corinthians 4. He says this, "Do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." Now, here's what's of interest to me. Paul is saying that we live in two dimensions at the same time. We live in a world that's beyond just what we can see and experience with our five senses. No, there's a whole other dimension invisible to the naked eye. But in that realm, there's an animation going on. And so what Paul is saying, we have to learn to train ourselves to see and perceive that world. We have to learn how to, you could say, bump into goats on cows from time to time. And so Paul is telling them, don't be discouraged. There's more going on below the surface. There's more than meets the eye here. Paul is coaching them, you could say, to pick up and see what Dante saw, that God is the love that moves the sun and other stars. The world is enchanted. There are goats on cows to be spotted. The trouble is, of course, and Paul understood this, is that these things are not so easy to see. We have to train ourselves to see and perceive. And especially today, that enchanted world is hard to tap into. It's hard to see. And so what I want to do this morning is I want to talk about two reasons why it's so hard to see and perceive this enchanted world. And then I want to talk about three areas where we bump into the enchantment of this world and sometimes don't even know it. But when we bump into it, it's hard to deny. So two reasons it's hard to see the enchantment of this world, and three areas where we bump into it all the time. Consider science for a moment. Now, Christianity has a bit of a troubled history over the past 100 or so years with science. It started with, of course, seeing science as the enemy with the creation-evolution debate that went on years ago. But of course, it hasn't just stopped there. And much to my chagrin, the Christian path has sort of come to be seen as at odds with science. And it's played out in things like climate change and even now with COVID, people denying the science behind it. And there's no reason for science and faith to be at odds. There's no scientific fact I've discovered that's ever rattled my faith. They don't need to be at war or at odds with one another. But the thing is this, science has shaped the way we see and view the world. In fact, one of the reasons we fail to see goats on cows, you could say, or the invisible realities around us, is actually because of one of the sort of quasi-scientific arguments, in fact, for the existence of God. It's the watchmaker argument. You may have heard of it, but it goes something like this. Imagine you're, say, walking through a forest like this, and while you're walking through it, you notice on the ground a watch. And so you pick it up and you start examining it, and when examining it, you realize this is intricately designed and created. The only thing that you conclude is that this thing is so complex and intricately designed, surely it must have had a creator. The watch indicates that there's a watchmaker. It's the same for our created world. This world is so intricately designed, surely it is like the watch, and if there's a watch, there's a watchmaker. Now, the interesting thing about this argument, no matter how convincing you find it or whether or not you even do at all, but the interesting thing is the shift this did for us in the way we see and perceive the world. You see, the thing with a watch is once it's created and set to work, well, you don't really need the watchmaker anymore. The watchmaker no longer matters. And it sort of changed our perception the same way. We might have thought that God, because this world is so intricately designed, created our world. But once God set it in motion, well, what's the need of God then? God becomes distant, way out there. God is not the animating presence. God's the watchmaker. But as Dante says, no, God is much more involved in our world than that. God is the love that moves the sun and other stars. But with arguments like these, God became distant and far away. The world was set in motion, but we no longer need God. Before this perceptual shift, those who traveled the Jesus path saw the world as humming, reverberating with the presence and animating spirit of God, and it inspired awe and reverence and gratitude. But that's no longer how we see the world. It's something we study, say, in a science class. Second reason we have a hard time seeing the enchantment of this world actually, I think, comes down to the Protestant Reformation. And while I happen to think that most of what happened in the Protestant Reformation was for good, I think we lost something along the way. And I'm a very proud Protestant. I'm not saying we should turn our backs on it. But again, something shifted for us. I mean, consider the differences between Catholic churches, Protestant churches, the way they approach the world, you could say. The first time that I ever actually really entered a Catholic church was when I was on a bike tour in Munich, and we were biking around town with our tour guide, and he had to stop at this Catholic church. We were gonna go in and tour it, and as we were about to enter it, he said, hey, make sure you grab your water bottles. You're gonna wanna fill up at the cistern inside the Catholic church. And to be honest, at that point, I had no idea. I thought, hey, good idea. I'm gonna need some water on this ride. So I brought my water bottle in, and there's a cistern right in kind of the opening, the front area of the church. And I was about to fill up my water bottle in it. And my friend says, Brad, don't, that's holy water. Holy water? You mean there's two different types of water? Normal water, holy water? In the Catholic Church there is, this is the water you use to bless or cross yourself or baptize kids. This is not simple water for consuming. And that was just the beginning. As I got in the church building, and what I noticed is that there's just a complete overload sensation on your senses. There's the smell of the frankincense. There's candles burning everywhere. There's a kaleidoscope of color through the stained glass windows. There's art and sculptures everywhere. And it wasn't just this church. Whenever I've been touring Catholic churches in Europe or right here at home, entering into a Catholic church is almost like entering Narnia. It feels enchanted. Everything about the space communicates you have just entered sacred, mystical, enchanted space. Now contrast that with many Protestant churches. First of all, you go to them and it just looks nondescript. It could be a community center, an auditorium, doesn't really matter. But once you're inside, there's pews, maybe there's some theater lights, cords, drum set, cables all over the place. But nothing about Protestant churches, by and large, communicates that this is any sort of special place. And that's not by accident. The idea was to try to communicate God is not found in a building. But something was lost, because in most of these churches, it just feels like there's nothing special here. This is not sacred space. Or consider the way we think about time. Prior to the Protestant Reformation, the church world, those who followed the Jesus path would have followed the liturgical calendar. Daily rituals, calls to prayer, prayer hours. The whole year was set up as a different sort of time. There's seasons and feasts, and many of us are, of course, familiar with, say, maybe Advent or Lent. But all throughout the year, there's ordinary time, different seasons, different sort of special occasions. The calendar isn't organized around our seasons, fall, autumn, but around a mystical sort of enchanted sense of time. Now contrast that to the way we view time today. Today is Sunday. Tomorrow will be Monday. It's the fall. The next big thing coming up is Christmas. There's nothing different about the way we see time and how everyone else sees time. Time is just linear. Or consider how Catholics and Protestants view saints. In our Protestant tradition, right, we believe everyone is a saint. It's sort of the equality of all believers. Everyone who follows the Jesus path is a saint. Now, of course, when everyone's a saint, it also means that kind of no one is a saint. I mean, you can have a Christian who's toxic and harmful. Are they really the same status as someone else who's perhaps much holier? But in the Protestant tradition, everyone's a saint, and something's lost there because when everyone's a saint, no one is. But contrast that to the Catholic view of saints. Those are special people. In fact, to be canonized as a saint, you have to have at least 2 miracles attributed to you. To be a saint is a big deal. What the Catholics believe is that there are certain people who are so holy, so in tune, in touch with God, that just being around them or being in their presence is like a thin place. It's a place where heaven and earth come close together. It's a reason, of course, that Catholics pray to saints as well. Some people are enchanted and special, and saints, something we can aspire to. And so the way they view saints is much different than us. And because we see everybody as saints, something enchanted is lost in the mix. Or consider Mass, Eucharist, Communion, whatever you want to call it. For Catholics, when you take the elements, you are witnessing a miracle. The elements, the bread and the wine, they turn into blood and flesh. Every single time you take the elements, you witness a miracle. And of course, there's debates and discussions to be had about that, but in our tradition, of course, we see the elements as mere symbols. It's a ritual we go through, but there's nothing magical happening. Nothing enchanted is taking place. Now, all that to say, I'm still a proud Protestant, and I think many of the changes that came about because of the Protestant Reformation were incredibly necessary and needed. But something was lost along the way, and it's made our faith today, I could say, maybe more flat, less dynamic, less vital or alive or enchanted. Because I think, no matter if you agree or disagree, what Catholics understand is something that we don't always get. And it's this: enchantment thrives when it's made visible. And I think we get that even here at Nexus. I mean, when I talk to people about some of our marquee moments as a church community together, I'm amazed at how often what comes up are those moments, events, those Sundays where we animated a space, where there was art and there was dance, there was music, there was stuff to look at, lights, things like glimpses, other events that we've done where we sort of animate. You could say what we do in those moments is make visible the enchantment of this world. And we've lost a lot of that along the way. And so, of course, we have a hard time seeing goats on cows and realizing that the world around us is enchanted when our faith becomes just about moral pageantry, being better people, or when we come to see God as a distant watchmaker, or when we lack the visual cues and reminders that our world is enchanted. It's going to be hard for us to see goats on cows, to learn to see and perceive the world as enchanted. And yet, while that might be so, there are still areas where we just can't deny it. Try as we might, there are locations in life where we just can't shake this idea that there's something more going on. And so what I want to do is highlight for you 3 areas where we bump into goats on cows, we bump into God, mystery, magic, enchantment. Consider nature as an enchanted run-in that we often have. Now, I always like to sort of give descriptions to places I've been. If you were to say to me, what is the most beautiful place you've ever seen, Brad? I might point to maybe the Swiss Alps. Or if you were to say, what's the most haunting place you've ever been? And in a good way, I would for sure point to the desert terrain of the US Southwest. But if you were to say to me, what is the most enchanted place you've ever been to? I would without hesitation say Cathedral Grove on Vancouver Island. It's an old growth forest, and you know, there's probably little point in me trying to describe it, but there's just something completely magical and enchanted about that place. It's a combination of things with this place. I mean, it's like the way the air smells in there. It's just the energy of the place, the energy you feel being inside it. It's the way the moss hangs around the whole forest as if it's been entrusted with memories. It's just a combination of things that make you feel like you've entered into someplace special, something magical. It feels enchanted. And I wasn't alone. My brothers and I were with me. And of course, they have a whole, between the 4 of us, there's a spectrum of beliefs there. And the words that all of us used to describe it were charmed, magical, enchanted, inspiring energy. Something special about that place. And being in the forest is not just the size of the trees or the energy there, it's the age. You just feel almost a sense of wisdom being in there. I mean, most of the trees in there are about 500 years old. The oldest one in the Cathedral Grove is over 600 years old. The oldest tree on Vancouver Island is over 1,000 years old. In fact, the oldest tree ever found in Canada was over 1,600 years old. I mean, walking amongst trees that old, you just feel humbled and silenced. There's something magical about a place like that. We sense these things. We know these things. Even if you don't believe in a god or in an enchanted world, I'm inclined to think that even the most hardened skeptic can't help but feel something more in a place like Cathedral Grove or in an old-growth forest. There's something special there that even the most skeptical among us feel. I think for many of us, our sense of enchanted is at its peak or most poignant when we're in nature. Because I think even, again, the hardest of us are tempted to think that in an old-growth forest, there's something more to it than just a collection of atoms and chemistry and raw material. And this is what is of interest to me. Without a sense of enchantment, a place like that just becomes more raw material. And yet, we know that we resist that idea. We resist the idea that an old-growth forest is the same as, say, that tree in your backyard. Chopping down a tree in Cathedral Grove would feel like a violation. It would feel profane. And so we sense in places like that that there's something more going on. And the problem is this, without a sense of enchantment, all it is raw material. A place like Cathedral Grove becomes a great place to get some lumber. Why not cut it down? But we know that, our better angels know that there's something more going on, that something different about certain places, and that places of beauty, places of nature need to be protected and preserved. And why? Because we sense there's something more going on. Second, what we hold to be true of at least some of nature, we hold to be true about human beings as well. You see, we hold today that all lives matter. All human life is sacred. We believe that Black lives matter, Indigenous lives matter, because they've been often ignored and overlooked. But we hold this to be a truth, that all human life matters. But the thing is this, it requires a sense of enchantment to believe that. It's not intuitively obvious or straightforward that all human lives do matter. And so, in order to fully come and believe that life is sacred, that humans deserve dignity and respect, all of us, no matter who we are, that requires a sense of enchantment with this world. You know, I've become really taken with Andrew Root. He's written a number of really influential books. His book, Pastor in a Secular Age, is just mind-blowing to me. And he gets underneath this sense of enchantment, and he says this about how we understand and view humans. The moral vision of our disenchanted world is built upon a fundamental enchantment, the belief in the sacred worth of every human being. The moral foundation of the modern secular world would collapse without this belief, the conviction that every human being is imbued with inestimable value and dignity. Our belief in universal human rights, the linchpin of secular morality, depends on this sacred recognition. The great hypocrisy of our skeptical age is that its greatest moral accomplishment, a moral vision founded upon universal human rights, depends on enchantment, a belief in the sacred character of human beings and life. No scientific equation or empirical test reveals this truth to us. The inviolate dignity of human persons doesn't show up in petri dishes, brain scans, or Hubble Space photographs. Our shared belief in the sacred value of human beings is not a factual, empirical, testable, observable, data-driven claim. Our dignity is an enchantment. The ghost of God still haunting the machine, and it's this bit of supernaturalism that keeps the secular world from tipping into the moral abyss. More and more people might doubt the existence of God, but God still haunts us. We crave the magic. We resist reducing our lives to biology. We are convinced that we are more than the sum total of our organs, bones, and tissues. Just like reducing redwood trees to lumber, there's something sociopathic about a purely scientific, materialistic description of human beings. When redwood trees lose their sacred magic, it becomes very easy to cut them down. And the same goes for human beings. Oh, wow. I mean, oh, those sentences, I mean, they sum up for me why I follow the Jesus path. And to be honest, why I can't ever fully embrace humanism or secularism. There's no metaphysical basis for the sacred dignity of all human life, but the Jesus path insists it is true. Each and every one of us are sacred. Each and every one of us deserves dignity and respect. All of us do. And why? Because we're made in the image of God. And when you lose that sense of enchantment, when you lose that magic, well, bad things can happen. Finally, we can't escape the enchanted nature of our world because we can't shake the idea that our lives have meaning. Viktor Frankl and his wife were imprisoned in Auschwitz in October of 1944. And Viktor Frankl, of course, was a psychiatrist. And not only did he suffer in this concentration camp, but he observed camp life there. And ultimately, his reflections on what he saw there ended up in his groundbreaking, like the huge book, Man's Search for Meaning. And what Viktor Frankl found in the concentration camps was this, is that those who couldn't find or pair any sort of meaning with their suffering, they had a hard time carrying on. They had a hard time surviving and moving forward. But those people who were able to connect some sort of meaning to their suffering, they were able to bear the burden and weight of their suffering. It gave them the strength they needed to carry on. As Viktor Frankl succinctly put in his book, those who have a why to live can bear with almost any how. Meaning is vital in life. It's vital for our mental health and well-being. And yet without God, without a sense of enchantment, we are forced to create our own meaning. And that puts us on very fragile ground. In fact, it doesn't put us far from Double Rainbow Guy. I mean, it's one thing to scoff at Double Rainbow Man for thinking those rainbows meant something, or it's one thing to scoff at Elise O'Kane maybe thinking that being saved from a doom flight meant something, but we're a whole lot less likely to scoff at the idea that maybe our roles and tasks and duties throughout the day, our jobs as parents and teachers and friends, that maybe those mean nothing as well. I think the truth is that the void of this universe doesn't care about your job, your children, how marginalized you are, how stressed out you are, or how heartbroken you are. It just doesn't. And so we can make up our meaning and say our life and our tasks and stuff has meaning, but is that any more far-fetched than Double Rainbow Man thinking those rainbows meant something for him? The idea that our lives have meaning and value, that we matter as human beings, is complete nonsense from a purely factual point of view. The thing is this, you don't believe that now, do you? Of course you don't, and you shouldn't. The belief that we cling to, that we matter and have meaning, is something we refuse to surrender. Beyond it all, we still hope and suspect that maybe, just maybe, there's something more, something beyond us that sees us and cares about us. We cling to the idea that even though we live in a world of 7 billion people, in a cosmos where we're just a tiny speck, a dot in the big, vast universe, we still cling to the idea that our lives matter and have significance. But thinking that is about as reasonable as Double Rainbow Man thinking those rainbows were put there for him. And yet we still cling to the idea. We still hope it to be true. And the Christian path announces, your suspicions are correct. You do matter. You don't have to make up your own fragile meaning. You don't have to invent it because it has been given to you by the creator of the universe. You do matter. I mean, consider the words of Jesus here. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside your Father's care. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. We might be blind to it. And there are often obstacles in the way that make it hard for us to see. But the truth is, we sense that our world is enchanted. And be it when we're in nature in some magical place, or whether we insist and know that our lives matter and have meaning, the truth is that the world feels enchanted to us in these places. And of course, none of these prove, of course, that God exists or that the world is in fact enchanted, but we can't shake the ache that we have for that. We can't shake that we have this thirst and hope that maybe it's in fact true. These things, they point to something, an ache, a thirst, a longing for a world that's enchanted, a world where we might get to bump into God from time to time, a world where there are goats on cows, a world that's mysterious and enchanted. And so over the next few weeks, I want to invite us to keep looking and searching into that reality. But for this morning, may you have eyes to know we live in an enchanted world.